Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, a host of the Public Policy Channel, and we are joined today by Lewis A. Grossman, who's the author of Choose Your Medicine, Freedom of Therapeutic Choice in America from Oxford University Press. So, Lewis, if you would, to kick us off, I wonder if you might tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and your background and what it is that brought you to this particular project.
First of all, Stephen, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I am a professor of law at American University in Washington, D.C., focusing on food and drug regulation, on health law, and on American legal history. In addition to having a law degree, I also have a PhD in American history. And this book brings together my passions in what was a very fulfilling way for me. I have been thinking about the issues that I talk about in the book for many years now. I want to make clear from the start that I started writing this book 5 or 6 years before anybody had ever heard the phrase COVID or the word COVID-19. And I will tell you what the genesis of it was in a moment, but I will say that finishing the book during the pandemic was an interesting experience because so many of the themes that emerge in the book are being illustrated so well by events of today. And I felt that it would be a disservice to the book and to readers to not incorporate as much as of COVID into the book as possible. And so I did the best I could, but ultimately there's just a due date and I had to stop. I've always been interested in the issue of freedom of therapeutic choice. As a academic, as an author, as a teacher, one thing that really enhanced my focus on the issue was a case called Abigail Alliance in the early 2000s. Abigail Burroughs was a accomplished, wonderful young woman from Falls Church, Virginia, who, while a student at the University of Virginia, got head and neck cancer. Every available therapy didn't work. And she got into the desperate situation where her only remaining recourse was unapproved drugs. And she tried to obtain unapproved drugs and was unable to do so and ultimately died of head and neck cancer not long afterward. And I was always really compelled by her story. And her father, Frank Burroughs, shortly after her death, founded an organization called Abigail Alliance. And Abigail Alliance soon brought a lawsuit against FDA, demanding that people in Abigail's situation have the right to purchase unapproved drugs from companies without FDA interference. And in the D.C. Circuit, which is often called America's second most important court, she initially won a dramatic victory, but ultimately the entire court heard the case en banc and decided that there is no due process right, substantive due process right, to obtain unapproved drugs. And so that itself is an incredibly compelling discussion to have. But in addition to that, in deciding Abigail Alliance, the court used a test from an assisted suicide decision called Glucksberg, which says that a fundamental right must be deeply rooted in America's history and traditions. And so both the majority and the dissenters in the decision examined whether therapeutic choice was deeply rooted in America's history and traditions. And they told very different histories, and they were both very simplistic histories. And I wanted to figure out the truth. So I dove in. And as a historian, I didn't limit myself to reported cases and statutes. I went to a huge range of materials, from pamphlets to magazine articles, to descriptions of parades and demonstrations, to legislative and administrative hearings, to veto messages by governors, and examined these things over the entire course of American history. And I drew various lessons that we can talk about from this examination, but the basic principle or the basic conclusion I have is that throughout American history, with a small exceptional period in the mid-20th century, a broad swath of the population has believed that people have a right to choose their preferred medical treatments without government interference.
So perfect. So why don't we use that as an opportunity to dig into some of that history and tradition? Why don't we start? And we'll just for listeners, we are not going to be able to cover all of it. That's why the book exists. But why don't we start, if you would, tell folks a little bit about what you describe as the first broad medical freedom movement, the Thomasonians. Who were they, and how? And you lay out sort of the core themes or arguments they used to make their case. Maybe lay those out for us, and then we can explore the ways those play out throughout other periods in our history.
Sure. Well, the first thing to understand is I realized as I started my research that if you are researching activism against perceived medical tyranny, it's not enough to just look at regulation of drugs as FDA and DEA regulate drugs today. For much of American history until the early 20th century, the main target of medical freedom activism was medical licensing. That is, systems that try to restrict medical practice to people with certain education or certain knowledge or certain credentials. And this was used from the beginning of American history by the Orthodox medical profession to try to limit the freedom of alternative practitioners to practice. And this was responded to very negatively, not just by the practitioners themselves, but by their followers. And these were really, really popular movements. So let's start with Thomsonianism. Samuel Thompson was an itinerant folk healer from northern New England who invented an alternative medicine system. Now, alternative to what? Well, at the time, Orthodox medicine was in what is known as its heroic medicine phase, where doctors approach treatment largely through very enervating treatments like mercury-based purgatives and emetics and extensive bleeding of patients and other type extreme measures.
Like literally draining massive quantities of blood out of people.
Exactly. And in fact, I tell the story of George Washington's death where He may not have died from the throat infection he had if he had not gotten so much blood drained from
his body.
He had
alternative treatment rather than orthodox medicine in that instance.
That's right. Now, Samuel Thompson constructed an alternative system based on vegetable substances, mainly lobelia and cayenne pepper, and as well as steam baths. And his system became an extraordinarily popular approach to medicine in the years well before the Civil War, the 1820s and the 1830s and the 1840s. And it was more than just a preference. It was a passion. And one of the things that threatened the Thompsonians was the system of medical licensing that had been established in many states in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And they attacked this system. They didn't attack it in court, and probably would not have been successful if they had. But nonetheless, their movement was a deeply constitutional movement based on American constitutional principles, fought in legislatures and in the streets and in widely spread literature. And in a dramatic development, they succeeded in utterly dismantling American medical licensing. Early in the 19th century, virtually every state had a medical licensing system. By the Civil War, many of the statutes had been revoked, and even those statutes that remained were not rigorously in force. Now, one other thing I focus on in this extraordinary movement is the fact that the strains of freedom rhetoric that the Thompsonians used went well beyond what we are most used to talking about, which is bodily freedom, bodily autonomy. Certainly that was part of what they were arguing, but there were some other very important strains in their rhetoric, including freedom of conscience and religion, economic freedom, in particular opposition to monopolies, as well as freedom of inquiry. And one of the themes of the book is that none of these alternative strains, and I shouldn't call them alternative strains because it sounds like I'm talking about alternative medicine, but none of these other strains of freedom rhetoric have ever really gone away. And bodily freedom has not always been the leading strain of freedom rhetoric. And these others have all had their days in the sun and all have continued to exist. And you can see all of them to some extent in the COVID medical libertarianism that we see around us today.
So before we get there, and we're absolutely going to talk about COVID, you made reference to this sort of extended period of contestation over licensing and expanding and withdrawing and then expanding again over large chunks of history, with this exception of the mid-20th century, 1930s to 1960s period, which seems to be sort of this moment of accommodation to Orthodox medicine, which obviously looks very different in that period than it had previously. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in that period and why you think we see that anomaly? And then we'll move forward into the present a little bit more.
So by that period, you're talking about the mid-20th century, the golden age of medicine?
Yes.
So this is what I thought was the norm when I was a little kid. In America,
right,
that had immense trust in its establishment institutions, in its government, in its scientific establishment, in its medical establishment, even in its big businesses. And during this period, in the wake of victory in World War II, which was driven by scientific innovation as well as the bravery of soldiers and the leadership of generals, Americans started to embrace an extraordinary level of trust in American medicine and in American government health regulation and in the cooperation between them and in the pharmaceutical industry. Now, this was partly due to some very dramatic developments, very real developments in terms of therapies. This was an era following the rise of modern antibiotics that made terrible infectious diseases that had been the scourge of populations since time immemorial, all of a sudden treatable nuisances. And in addition to that, we had an efflorescence of vaccine development, where all of these terrible childhood diseases that had been so problematic for human history were now largely preventable. And of course, the most dramatic episode of all was the invention of the polio vaccine by Jonas Salk and the rollout of it to a very, very welcoming American population. And Jonas Salk was a huge American hero in the 1950s. I compare his level of celebrity to that of Mickey Mantle, the baseball player, or James Dean, the movie star, both of whom he was a contemporary of. And during this period, the American medical establishment churned out what were thought to be wonder drugs and miracle cures. And the level of resistance to that establishment, and therefore the level of medical freedom activism, was much lower in that period than in any other period in American history. I will add that there was medical freedom activism during this period. It tended to be right-wing activism, and it tended to be focused on the most frightful area where Orthodox medicine had made little progress, and that's cancer. So there is very, very robust, although marginal, activism with respect to cancer therapies throughout what we now think of as the golden age of medicine.
So as you say, this changes after this period. This period really is anomalous. What happened?
What happened was the 1970s.
The answer to all of the questions about why do we have this weird anomalous mid-20th century period in everything we want to look at.
That's right. You know, the 1970s for a while were viewed as the decade in which nothing happened. But the 1970s were a huge inflection point in American history. And what the change was a dramatic decline in trust of establishment institutions, from government to science to medicine to big business to the media. And it was a bipartisan disintegration of trust. And that's one of the very important points I want to get across in my book, because it very much affects medical freedom activism in the 1970s and going forward. Now, what was this caused by? World War II was becoming a more distant memory. You had in the early 1970s, the Vietnam War, you had Watergate, stagflation, an oil crisis. You also had a couple of episodes that gave science and medicine in particular black eyes. In the world of nuclear science, you had the Three Mile Island accident in Pennsylvania, which led to an almost meltdown of a nuclear power plant, which certainly diminished Americans' confidence in nuclear energy and its promise as a source of non-polluting energy for time, forever in the future. Medicine got a black eye in a largely now forgotten episode in 1976 called The Swine Flu. It was about the swine flu. The Ford administration, which of course Ford had taken over from Nixon after Nixon's resignation about Watergate, the Ford administration announced that a deadly swine flu was descending upon the United States of America, and he wanted to get every American vaccinated against the swine flu. And it was a huge public campaign supported by the medical establishment, including Jonas Salk. President Ford rolled up his sleeve, got the vaccination in the Oval Office, foreshadowing exactly what Biden did with the COVID vaccine a couple of months ago. And the swine flu never really arrived on America's shores. And predictably, there were people who suffered from side effects from the vaccine, as is always going to happen. The Ford administration surrendered, abandoned the program, and was subject to attacks for its incompetence, along with the medical establishment's incompetence, from both the right and the left.
So let's flash forward, if we can, and skip over all sorts of super interesting things, and talk a little bit about activism around access to drugs during the AIDS pandemic, and then we'll use that as a way to bring us up to the present and talk about what's going on in what I would argue, and I think you would argue, is a very different kind of activism around COVID and vaccination. So what do we learn by looking at AIDS activism in the 80s and 90s?
So AIDS activism was in many ways a new sort of medical freedom activism in America, because it wasn't focused on alternative medicines. Right. It was focused on accelerating and easing access to products of the governmental, scientific, big business, university access that was producing pharmaceutical treatments. They just wanted them faster, and they wanted them before approval in many instances. So they didn't reject the importance of drug regulation or pharmaceutical science, but nonetheless, they did something very, very important that has had a permanent impact on American drug regulation. FDA philosophy prior to the AIDS activism was premised on the notion that the agency's job was to protect the public by keeping unsafe and ineffective medicines off the market. Therefore, when a medicine had not been shown to be effective pursuant to randomized controlled clinical trials, FDA's position was that the government should simply prohibit, in most instances, access to that drug, even if early research suggested that this might be of help to some patients, even patients in desperate situations, such as patients suffering from AIDS, which was at that point an incurable and inevitably fatal disease.
It was terminal.
The AIDS activists said was, hey, government, you should let us do the risk-benefit analysis with our doctors. You shouldn't be doing the risk-benefit analysis and deciding for me, who has AIDS, that no rational person could possibly take this drug with the risks it has based on its uncertain promise of efficacy. You should leave that to patients and their physicians much more than you have in the past. And they had dramatic successes. They revolutionized American drug regulation in various ways that are still true today. Today, drugs are approved much faster than they used to be. drugs are approved based on less evidence than they used to be. I mean, for example, it used to be the standard that you had to have two adequate and well-controlled phase three randomized trials in order to get drug approval. And I saw a recent statistic that in recent years, only around half of drugs meet that standard. Now, the AIDS activists also fought for access to drugs prior to approval. And they had a lot of success with that with respect to AIDS drugs in particular. There was a very, very robust distribution of pre-approved AIDS drugs in the late 80s and early 90s. The long-term impact of this has been less obvious. The system is set up now so that there is a regularized procedure for accessing drugs prior to approval in desperate situations. But there's nothing that requires pharmaceutical companies to provide those drugs. And for many reasons that we could discuss, pharmaceutical companies are in general not that enthusiastic about doing so. But right. The AIDS revolution truly was an astonishing one and changes all of our lives in ways that many people don't realize.
The other thing that in reading these chapters that again sort of struck me, if we put the AIDS activism against sort of the anti-vax activism, which I want to turn to next, is that, you know, there's a sort of I know people who make sort of jokes about, you know, sort of anti-vaxxers who, you know, do their own research, quote unquote. And that's, you know, random Google searching and picking and choosing things that happen to support their pre-existing beliefs. But a lot of the folks who emerged out of ACT UP and what formed the Treatment Action Group, they really did the research. They learned the science and became experts so that they could go into FDA and actually speak with them eventually as peers. Yes. Do you think that was an important, first, do you think I'm accurately characterizing what went on there? And how important do you think that was as part of that dynamic?
You are absolutely accurately characterizing what went on there. These were very, very smart people, many of whom had no particular background in science, who became extraordinary autodidacts, who became as expert at science and regulation as the people they were talking to. And it really was amazing. And in fact, it set the standard for patient advocacy in drug regulation going forward. There are these things called advisory committee meetings that often precede the approval of a drug. And before AIDS activism, those meetings were somewhat sparsely attended meetings attended by bureaucrats and scientists, maybe some people from major consumer advocacy organizations. Starting with AIDS and ever since, they can be raucous events with broad citizen participation and hooting and clapping and moreover, behind every controversially approved drug in recent years, there has been a patient advocacy organization led by people who, whether or not they themselves are scientists or physicians, can talk the talk very much the way that the AIDS activists did. I will say one other thing, though, which is that AIDS activism was not a completely homogenous phenomenon. Right. And the more that these treatment activists mastered the science, were invited into the halls of government and worked with bureaucrats and experts at the FDA and NIH, they developed a different attitude toward things and drifted away from a large part of the membership of ACT UP to the point where ultimately they just split away altogether. So I don't mean to suggest that AIDS activism itself was a uniform phenomenon.
So let's now in our last few minutes, bring us up to the present and talk a little bit about COVID. So for folks who have not yet read the book, Lewis covers much more history, including large chunks of the 19th century that we essentially ignored, as well as other more contemporary kind of fights about insurance, fights about medical marijuana, fights about physician-assisted suicide. Thinking of all of those issues and all of that history, tell us how you think about what's going on in this particular moment.
Well, if I could just put in a plug for those chapters very briefly.
Of course.
So the late 19th century was a fascinating one where a whole bunch of other alternative medicine philosophies arose. Many of them, drugless approaches like osteopathy and chiropractic and Christian Science and Mind Cure. And I find it quite fascinating the way that even as state after state re-embraced medical licensing, the system was both established and enforced in a way that accommodated these alternative practitioners to an extraordinary extent. In the early 20th century, I tell a fascinating story about what seems to be kind of just an anodyne bureaucratic reorganization proposal to take all of the public health functions of the federal government and put them under one roof in a new department called the National Health Department. And this riled up segments of the American public to a degree that it ended up getting defeated as a threat to American medical liberty, and even as a tyrannical plot by the AMA to take over American medicine. So, but let's now go up to the future. And if you could re-ask your final question to me again, I'd appreciate it.
So given the work that you've done in this book, and sort of as you think about the long history of medical freedoms movement, how would you encourage us to think about what's going on right now with battles over vaccination and public health measures and credibility of different kinds of medical and public actors? How do you think about COVID and what's going on currently?
So there's a couple of dichotomies I want us to think about when we're talking about COVID. One is treatments for communicable disease versus treatments for diseases that may be fatal to the person who has the disease but are not of danger to other people. And even as I talk about the long American history of medical libertarianism, that was largely, although certainly not only, about the latter category of disease. Indeed, in the early 20th century, a now well-known case called Jacobson at the U.S. Supreme Court held that when it comes to communicable diseases, people do not have a right, substantive due process right, to reject a vaccine because your individual choice has an effect on the community. Another dichotomy I'd like to briefly mention is that between the freedom to resist compelled treatment, government-compelled treatment on the one hand, which is usually in the form of a vaccine, versus the freedom to obtain drugs that you want to have without government interference. And when I started to write the book, I was focusing mostly on the latter phenomenon because there had been a lot of really good scholarship and popular writing on vaccines and vaccine resistance and vaccine hesitation in American history. And it was really the movements for access to drugs that people wanted that I wanted to put together in a synthetic fashion in a way it had never been done before. But that being said, the whole time I was researching it, I was very aware that there are very, very important philosophical and ideological, as well as organizational overlaps between vaccine resistors on the one hand, and people who demand access to unapproved or unorthodox right. medicines on the other hand. And you have seen this really come to the fore with COVID, because it's important to remember that COVID medical freedom activism is not just about resisting vaccines. It's also about demanding access to hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or whatever drug that the orthodox medical establishment has not embraced, that the conservative media, for the most part, is promoting in that month. I will mention something else, by the way, that, you know, one thing that may seem different about COVID activism is its, let me call it, monopartisanship as opposed right. to bipartisanship. It seems like a conservative movement. And this is different, certainly, from medical freedom ideology in general in American history, but it does have precedence. The Thompsonians, whom we spoke about earlier, were very closely allied with the Jacksonian Democratic Party. As I mentioned, the medical freedom activism in favor of cancer therapies in the 1950s had very much a right-wing valence. And then I will add that I have a relative who's a physician, my sister, and she was sent a book by an ex-patient who decided that he didn't appreciate her embrace of science and orthodox medicine, by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., right. an entire new book from the progressive side blasting Anthony Fauci and vaccines and the medical government establishment. So even this one has something of a bipartisan aspect to it.
But he's very much the exception rather than the rule. Although pre-COVID, my read is that sort of there were more anti-vaxxers sort of on the putative left than there were on the right. Do you have a sense of that?
Well, I don't know whether it was more on the left or more on yeah. the right, but following the 1970s phenomena that I talked about, right. when anti-vaccinationism arose as a modern movement in the 1980s, there were always, on the one hand, kind of naturopathic, progressive hippie types, but there were also always fundamentalist Christians and conservatives as well. It was very much bipartisan. The progressive embrace, for the most part, of the COVID vaccine, combined with the widespread conservative rejection of the COVID vaccine, is very different from the anti-vaccinationism we saw over the previous few decades that focused on childhood vaccines for things like measles. I mean, it's almost impossible to remember this, even though it was only a few years ago. But like in 2016 or so, there were measles outbreaks around the country. Right. And the anti-vaccinators became extremely unpopular in much of America. And the exceptions to state mandatory vaccination laws were being rolled back in many states. It will be interesting to see, when God willing, we emerge from this pandemic, whether the anti-vaccination impulse of conservatives in this country is focused mostly or exclusively on the COVID vaccine in particular, or on vaccines in general. And I will say that for a long time, the vaccines were being administered pursuant to what is known as an emergency use authorization, which is not the same thing as full FDA approval. And during that period, people resisting vaccines could differentiate it from other vaccines by saying, well, it's not fully approved. Well, that's not true anymore. And the anti-vaccination fervor doesn't really seem to have diminished. So what happens when we emerge from this horror with respect to basic childhood vaccines? And I heard somebody yesterday mention that in some southern states, there seems to be a emerging resistance to vaccination generally from the conservative side of our political spectrum.
You have been listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking with Louis A. Grossman about his new book, Choose Your Medicine, Freedom of Therapeutic Choice in America, new from Oxford University Press. Louis, thank you so much for joining us today. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Stephen, for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.